Well, welcome everybody. This is a session on Columbia. It's Courageous Congregations, and also picking up a little bit of the Just Peace discussion from yesterday and from earlier sessions. If the tape is there, it can start. My name is Jonathan Ferricks. I work for the World Council of Churches in Geneva. I work on disarmament and peace building. About 10 years ago, I think, at Holden, we were here, and there was a vow of nonviolence being discussed, I think, all summer, and at various times in the summer, after people had been through a bit of the program around what does nonviolence mean as a way of life, we were encouraged to take a vow of nonviolence. And I wasn't so sure I wanted to take a vow like that, because I didn't know how serious it was and what it would mean, but I went ahead with my daughter. And I just wanted to read you a part of it and relate it to where we left off yesterday with these four themes, ways to think of peace as something that is around you and something you're connected to. In the community, with the earth, in the marketplace, and among the peoples or nations. The first four or five of the vow parts go to all of those, I think. So, before God, the creator and sustainer of all life, and by the power of God's sanctifying spirit, I vow to carry out in my life the example of Jesus. First, persevering in nonviolence of tongue and heart through an openness to personal conversion. Second, working to create just relationships in the world, in our community, our family, our personal life. I think these all relate to all of these, maybe anchored here. Striving for peace within myself and seeking to be a peacemaker in my daily life through prayer and acts of forgiveness and reconciliation. Fourthly, refusing to participate in acts of violence or to retaliate in the face of provocation and seeking creative responses to conflict. Fifth, and this one is more about the marketplace. Living conscientiously and simply so that I do not deprive others of the means to live. I think if we were doing it today, we would see that both in economic terms and environmental terms, more than perhaps is used in those words. It's implied. And then here's one about the peoples, actively resisting the evils of oppressive structures and the causes of war. And then finally, back to all of them, I think, embracing the redemptive suffering of Jesus and believing in the transforming power of the cross. So that was, I think, in this room, and I think about 150 people took that file here at Holden, and it was maybe 10, 12 years ago. And I think it's interesting how many of the themes that we talk about today were clearly on the agenda as we discussed it then. I want to spend about half of this session or a little more on Columbia, and then try to invite your participation in looking for parallels and connections, both to that, and if you were here for Israel-Palestine in the earlier part of the week, or you bring with your own knowledge and experience questions of peace and justice, feel free to bring them to bear. And keep, when I say peace and justice, I mean it's close to you. Peace is close to you. Global peace is close to you, in the sense that our world is more interrelated than ever. And we can see ourselves with a peace ministry, even though we would never have said that. And when we think of blessed are the peacemakers, we might be thinking of, you know, St. Francis and a couple other people. They qualify, but me? And so I'd like to challenge you by seeing parallels from places where the globe is hot with conflict and violence to a place here where it's much harder to see the violence, and violence needs to be understood in a rather broader way, but not in an abstract way at all, in a very concrete way. So a little bit of an introduction to Colombia. Have any of you been there, the country of Colombia, in the northern part of South America? One person, okay. Hard, wet song we heard for breakfast, if you were in there at about 8 o'clock, about what a wonderful world we live in. Hard to imagine a more beautiful place than Colombia. They have shining sea and blue sky and towering mountains and verdant forests and gardens, and the way to say it better than anything else is they swear, and I believe them because I grew up in a tropical country that I thought was the richest place in the world naturally. It's pretty close, I think, Papua New Guinea. But Colombia might have Papua New Guinea beat. They say you can eat a different fruit every day of the year. And you won't repeat yourself. And I believe it. I think I got up to about 100 in several visits. And fruits you never even knew existed, and they taste really good. And they look like two fruits we know or have heard of might have gotten married and then produced another kind of offspring. But it's also the place where I think the church, the global family of Christians that we're part of, is actually face to face with violence in a more dramatic and a more immediate way than I think anything I've seen. I've seen worse in war zones, but this is endemic, chronic, about 50 years really, 50 years of civil conflict, violent conflict in Colombia. They talk about la violencia, starting in the late 1940s. And to just give you an idea of how that could happen, very difficult in the short time, we should do the whole week on it, but I think it's possible to get an idea. It's not some fate that descended upon them, and oh, isn't it a pity? You have to start at least with the conquista, the Spanish occupation of the so-called New World. And I want to say, if you were here last week or other times at Holden, how often the deepest problems of conflict in a country go back to an occupation, a foreign force who comes in and takes over. And you have to say that's what the Spanish were doing, as we then soon did here, we white people who came to America not too long after. So you start with occupation or conquista. You quickly add into that equation slavery. And here's a fact. What percentage of the Colombian public, the population, do you think is Afro-Colombian? The lady who's been there? No idea. It's 25%. And it's stunning to us, I think, because I'm relatively well informed, but until I went there, I had no idea. And it's because they're not invisible, but they're sort of invisible. You have to go out off the beaten track to find them, because that's where they've been pushed. They've been pushed, in many cases, to the edges of the society and into the parts of the country where they're cheek by jowl with the native Colombians, the Indios, you know, the Indians of South America, we use that term. So you've got occupation, slavery, local people who are on the brunt of the occupation, obviously, and then over time, some enormous amount of inequality between wealth, land, power. And the best way to understand the civil war is it's sort of like a war between city-states. So you've heard of Medellin? Medellin is an armed city in different ways. Not so obvious, but it's there. They have their own militia. They have their own paramilitaries, they're called. Same thing with Cali. You've heard of Cali, the Cali cartel? Name your city, and there may be a tradition of the elite of that city going back into the colonial times, sort of looking out for themselves in this place where occupation wasn't all that stable. The local people didn't agree to get themselves squashed for 500 years, that the slaves revolted or were freed up ultimately, even if they weren't necessarily raised up in society. And what's interesting is it's a society that's divided by land and wealth and power, like most societies, perhaps a little more dramatically than some. But you have to look with take off your sunglasses and let the color shine through. The injustice is arranged by race. So the people who are in the worst situation are the people who are either Indians, indigenous people, let's call them indigenous people, or Afro-Colombians. And then you have every kind of mixture of indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, European stock, in like you do in many parts of Latin America, in mestizos, cholos, groups like that, the words are used. And then some people who are totally European looking, and among them are generally where the elites are found. One real important thing, if you follow the news and got confused, is there's really three armed groups, and the level of violent conflict between them and among them is slowly going down. Whether the problems underneath are being solved is a bit of a different question. But paramilitaries are really the people that go with those elites. They're the hired hands. They themselves aren't elites. They're the young men who are pressed into service to serve the interests of the landowners, city by city. And so they're paramilitary groups that are quite violent and actually have the worst record, I think, at current time. They do the most killing and stealing and raping and other things, displacing of people. Then you have the guerrillas. In response to that huge inequality, what happened in the 60s? They had left-wing guerrillas, Marxist guerrillas. You've all heard of, and you know the acronym of the most famous one?
FARC.
FARC. It's the one where you gotta get that last consonant correct, or it'll sound like something else. Okay, FARC, and then ELN is another one. And these are, ELN's smaller, FARC is the biggest one, it's the one, they all kidnap, all of them kidnap, maybe the army, yeah, the army kidnaps too. But it's a way to make money. Are they leftists now? Well, sort of. But they're broken up and into groups with leaders, and these guys basically live from running drugs. And the ideology has gone out of it, but as a way of life in a disordered society where the gun can still earn you a living through the manipulation of leaders and commanders. These two groups have done a lot of damage. The army was sort of nowhere in Colombian history. It was sort of like the militia of Bogota, the capital. And it was weaker than the militia of the various powerful cities. And then gradually, with a lot of U.S. help, it's become a national army. And it's been the key instrument to put forward a policy under a president named Uribe, who just left office and has been succeeded by a person from his own party. Rank was president for several terms, and his policy was democratic security. And that sort of idea that you can do a democracy, you can do a little more justice through force and through control, using the army and using a lot of USA. Plan Colombia, $5 billion, generated by our concern for the amount of drugs that were coming from there and the need to spray and spray and spray and try and kill the coca plants. But also concern about disorder in general and the way that terrorism could find a home there, we say. And so including Colombia in the war on terror in quite a big way. And I think our embassy in Bogota is the second biggest U.S. embassy in the world. It was the biggest when I was there, but now the one in Baghdad is bigger. So you need a big embassy when you're busy putting a lot of money and force into another country the way we are there. And I'll come back with a church recommendation to the U.S. from the partners of Lutheran World Relief, where I used to work, which puts some of this in perspective. Maybe just a little bit more about it. What else could I say, or should I say? That's probably enough. I'll give you some specific examples of what you see and why I say the church is face to face with violence in a really dramatic and powerful and convincing way. But before I do that, any questions about this quick overview? My experience in going there from a country with this history was I've never met so many nice people in one place as ever. It's like the upheaval they've lived with, the fear, the kidnappings, the law of the jungle, even in the cities in the big cities for a while. A man we worked with had to give him an armed guard and an armored car. He was a civil society peace worker, but he'd been named by the paramilitaries and his life was in danger. So the project had to get an armed guard. And yet people, I think, have tried to counter that by being supportive, friendly, polite, reaching out in a way that's really striking. So to come on a little visit there, this was just last March when the group that wrote that statement I showed you part of, that second draft last night, met actually in Bogota, and we alternated our sessions of trying to write that thing with going out and seeing what the church is doing there. When I say the church, I want to put in first place the Mennonites. Second place, maybe everybody else. The Catholics are good, the Lutherans do something, the Presbyterians do something. The Council of Churches has a wonderful NGO named Justa Paz, in Spanish, Justice Peace. Justa Paz, they put the two words into one. And they do excellent work. So we went to a little place called Comedor Pan de Vida. So pantry or kitchen, or dining hall, comedor, place you can eat, comedor, bread and life. And it was in a place called Los Pinos. It was called Los Pinos in a suburb called Suacho, a huge, sprawling, grows by itself, unplanned suburb up the mountainside on the far northern end of Bogota. And Bogota is quite high, like a lot of the Andean capitals. And you go from a very developed city, a very pleasant city, to an increasingly sprawling and chaotic. And what happens in these places, the people essentially go and grab the land, put up shanties, do what they need to do. The streets look like Holden Path. They look like the path to Heart Lake, climbing up the side of the mountain. Build things out of cinder blocks, and gradually improve them, and finally they get city water, maybe, and sanitation, and the city recognizes the neighborhood. And as we drive in, you see a man under a tree with a book and a little desk under the tree outside, and as we went by, the Mennonite guide said, that's the urbanista. The urbanista is the sort of the real estate developer in a place of land grab. So they sort of grab the land themselves, and then they'll sell you little tiny lots for a modest amount of money. It's not their land to sell. It's not really yours to buy, but it's all happening in a spirit of forced expansion, because urbanization, you've heard about it, people coming to cities all over the world, half the world now lives in cities. These are the people that make that statistic true.
Whose land is it?
Well, it's hard to say. It's maybe nobody's, it may be the state's, it may be somebody who can't stop you. It's not land anybody really wants or anybody else had wanted. So when you go to the places where the violence is worst, you're going to places that are really on the margins in every sense of the word, ecologically, geographically, in terms of facilities or anything. But that's where the impoverished people are, the uprooted people are, and that's where the violence is worst, at the back end of this structure I'm talking about. Ultimately, it gets recognized. But I don't think it's so different. It's probably what happened as people went west. You know, just think back. Where did I mean, of course there were land plans in Oklahoma, but I bet you for everyone like that, where you've got, you know, 5 acres and a donkey or whatever it was, that was, I guess, the Depression. But anyway, it can happen informally. This is very informal. So Comedor Pan de Vida handles about, takes care of about 60 children a day. The children are from families who are internally displaced, and there have been 3.8 million people displaced in Colombia in the last 20 years. 3.8 million people by this violence. As these guys come in and clear you out of your valley because they want to grow coca, or they want to control it from the guerrillas, or vice versa, or from the army, the people are like pawns, pushed and harassed and chased out. They've told us, we used to have land, we don't have land anymore. We have land, we can't get to it. We were kicked off it 3 years ago. They fled the paramilitaries. They all mentioned the paramilitaries, the guerrillas, and the army. What they face in their new community is that there are gangs of young men who are forming up into gangs to make their own way in life if their society isn't offering them very much. But they're also recruiters for these armed groups. And the biggest fear of the women we met was that their 16-year-old son would be recruited by one of these. The recruiters come into the barrios and look for new young men to take out and to put into these things. The people, in some cases, were so afraid of what would happen to their children that they locked their children into their small homes, sometimes shanties, during the day, while the men went off to their construction jobs, if they had them, or to look for work, and the women went off to their cleaning jobs. And in some cases, they mentioned the prevalence of sex workers from these communities, going to the better parts of town and making it, trying to get some money for their families that way. The Comedor is in a way, it's a reverse parish. It's not go and build a church and invite the people to come. Go and build a pantry. Go and build a kitchen. Go and build a room where mothers can come and give each other support and learn a few critical skills about surviving in such a place. They have groups that work on human rights. Like every country, Colombia has good laws, but can the people make the laws stick? So that women learn about human rights, they learn about ways to resolve conflicts and deal with it locally, and things that they can do in their community. After a while, it could turn into a congregation. Maybe the women come on Sundays and say, well, let's worship. All of this is about are about the faith that we share with you, they're probably mostly lapsed Catholics, or maybe not even lapsed Catholics. And there are Catholics involved in the project, so it's not as if it's a sheep-stealing exercise. But you go from the kitchen to the church, right? From the church to the kitchen in a situation like that. And one of the most dramatic things we heard was that two things. One is, because of the connection, the trust of the women in this comedor, they were the project behind it, which was actually a local Mennonite parish in the center part of Bogota, were able to establish contact with the gangs through the women whose sons were involved. So they used they worked with the women to actually establish contact and dialogue. So I just read you the vow about nonviolence. It means you don't go around looking to arrest the gang leaders. You start by going to meet them, talk about them, and you find out, gee, they have some legitimate grievances, you know. The gang members, maybe. The leaders, maybe also, maybe not. But you at least start calling a spade, you speak truth to that local power, even if it's an illegal power, and some of the problems are solved in that patient way.
Where do the gangs fit in those three that you put on the board?
They're recruiting ground for these two, and maybe for this too. They're caught up in the politics of the country in different ways, but they're also involved in petty crime locally. Controlling, it's like you don't have police, somebody can see, oh, here's an opportunity. But I don't think that's the most important thing about them. It's the part you have to deal with as these mothers. But from our distance, we need to see them in a context. Here's a very scary thing. We began to hear a story from a different place we visited about something called false positives. They talked about, oh, so-and-so was a false positive. What? Well, in the daily news, and I think it's a little bit like the Fox News of Colombia, a positive is a dead gorilla. The government that we support and where all of our money has gone has said that all of Colombia's problems are here. The government's sort of rightist, and these are old, former leftists, but they pick that, they simplify that and say, that's the real problem. These guys are just protecting us from them, and these guys are just, so that's the real problem. So every time a gorilla is killed in a clash with the army, they call the dead gorilla a positive. So the news will say, there were 5 positives today in Cauca province, one of the most violent provinces where the drugs and the guns are traveling in every direction. So what's a false positive? Well, not every day, but it has happened, and we heard about it in 3 visits. One of these 16-year-old or 15-year-old or 17-year-old boys that has disappeared and been recruited apparently met somebody who said, hey, I can give you $20 if you come with me, and he describes a task on somewhere else. You know, I've got a job for you. And you go with the person, and the person takes you, and the next thing anybody else knows is you're found on the other side of the country dressed in a guerrilla uniform and dead. So the word we have to use here, and it's a good word for us to think about in our society because it's harder to see, but it's also present, is impunity. You know what impunity means? When you do something that just breaks, somebody with power, or somebody who takes power, breaks the rules of common sense and society and order and law, and does evil with impunity. So to reach into these dislocated, impoverished, vulnerable populations, find a young man, and his value is to kill him and put him in a uniform and claim him on the news.
Wow.
Beyond belief. Now, I couldn't tell, we couldn't tell, I didn't get clear statistics how much it happens, but it happens fairly regularly with small numbers of people. And then, of course, it gets alleged to be happening when maybe it isn't happening, but it's an incredible example of the conditions to which these least brothers and sisters are subjected. And right there with them, dealing with that, taking the cases to the police, taking the cases to the courts, being patient with the structures that exist, are these Mennonite peace projects and these church sanctuaries for peace. Very quickly, two other examples. We went to another place called St. Nicholas, and it was in another, not far from where we were before up on the hill, but this was down in the depths of the Bogota River. And once again, you're in a place that's essentially where the garbage would be dumped. The river was polluted, there was lots of stuff around. These people had claimed that land. It was a freestanding community with people putting up houses, but it was completely lawless. They started to get these false positives. And so they came to a little soup kitchen, essentially, another one from the same project by the Mennonite congregation downtown, and said, we've got to organize. And out of that have grown an enormous after-school program, a school lunch program, classes and all kinds of things that make a difference, where basically it's the community taking back its own space, taking back the streets, naming the misdeeds that are happening, going to those who commit them, and finding their voice. They call the little projects that are part of this yeast organizations. They call them yeast organizations. And they try to use that as a way to change the society in this little tiny place. So here we are, the river is still polluted, but the settlement we're in is orderly. There are no more of these wanton acts of violence committed between the suffering people, because they've taken control of themselves, and there's increasing recognition from the authorities, such as they are. And the sense of hope and power that were there was just amazing. It's everything from singing, to praying, to games, exercises. There was one game they were playing to try to show how you needed to cooperate. They give you 6 chairs and 30 people, and you had to see how could you all share those chairs. I mean, we could do it here, but you know, some of us are Lutherans, which means that we're mostly frozen, right? So if we played a game like this, it might be too much contact. But what you end up doing is you pick 3 strong people, and you say, okay, you take the chairs, and then you have somebody sitting on this knee, and then this knee, and this knee, and this knee, and you get this group of people sitting like that. And they're doing these kinds of exercises, sort of cooperative problem-solving games, because conflict isn't bad. Violent conflict is bad. Conflict is a problem you need to solve. And to see people breaking it down to that level, which I don't think we do enough of here. In fact, I always remember Holden, that game where you get a whole bunch of people together and you say, take 2 hands, any 2 hands in this big gaggle. Have you played that one? Yeah. I think it should be, Chuck, could you make that a feature of your administration? A weekly cooperative game. So you get out there, all of us, you take 2 hands in a big gaggle, and then you have to untangle yourselves into a circle. So you're going like this and like this. And it's really close contact. Lutherans get really nervous with it. But I think Presbyterians are a bit better at it. And you end up in a circle because actually you have 2 people's hands, and it's actually a circle, even though it looks like a knot. And that was the fun side. There was serious side, like I said, learning about human rights, learning about how to negotiate with people who have guns and knives, and you don't, and you will never have them, and making progress. One final quick glimpse of this contact. There is a Presbyterian home downtown that is a way station for people who have come to town because they've stepped on landmines. Colombia is one of the countries with millions of landmines left over from these 40, 50 years of war. And the day we went there was an indigenous family who were from the Amazon area and were walking on their own finca, their own territory, their own little farm in the jungle. And the 10-year-old girl was walking in front. I think the dad was here. The sister was there. The mom was there. And they all got wounded. And 3 of them were flown to the capital to go to the hospital where the Red Cross, it's fantastic to go around the world and find out the things that the International Red Cross, the Swiss Red Cross, the ICRC is doing in places of combat, and getting treatment. And they have to sit there for 2, 3, 4 weeks sometimes while they get the treatment they can't get in the bush. And the little girl was sitting there like someone who, she was obviously not in another world, but almost in another world. I mean, she just, no interest, not looking at anything. And after our visit, I had spent a little bit of time trying to talk to her in my not very good Spanish, and it didn't seem like it was very meaningful to her. But as we left, she came out to the porch. This is maybe after an hour, and I waved at her, and she had this one side of her body was sort of bandaged up and had pieces of metal in it, and she was going to lose part of her foot, and she cracked just the faintest of smiles and waved back. So a little sense of a very, very anonymous little family from the jungle, you know, hardly able to speak Spanish themselves. They're from indigenous, original Colombians, if you like, in this strange big city, suffering the leftovers of armed groups using weapons made in faraway countries, and I have to say, by countries who haven't signed the landmine ban, including our own. Remember, these things are banned now, and almost every country, except a few of the big guys, that's impunity right there, haven't signed the landmine ban. The weapon that can't tell a civilian from a soldier, ever. So that's a really sad and sobering note, but I think when you go there, you are enthused, empowered, excited by the ministry of the church face to face with this kind of endemic violence. And what they've done is systematized it in ways that are absolutely exceptional. And last night I talked about just peace as a journey. You know, we get there in the next life, but we go towards it and we climb towards it in this life. And I think these seeds of hope from the peace churches in Colombia demonstrate that in a wonderful way. Look at them. And I noticed, you know, they use the present, you know, the ING form. Not weave a new history. Weaving a new history. You're going to be weaving it for a while, maybe for a long time. A little bit like what I said last night from Brian McLaren about the gospel as the dominant story. Not something that serves your group, but that some of us for all of us. Weaving a new history. And the projects are full of people drawing what they've experienced, acting it out, where old women are facing young men with machetes and guns. But it's a play. They're acting out why they had to leave their village and trying to make sense of it and getting strength to go to the authorities and try to make law, the rule of law, come a little bit closer to them in Colombia. What do you think the irrefutable vocation of the church is?
Loving people, peace.
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 Loving people. The irrefutable vocation of the church. I didn't get that in my confirmation class as a good Lutheran. I'm a good Lutheran, quote unquote. You know, it was there, but it sure wasn't explicit. So God bless the peace churches. God bless those of us in the rest of the church who are inspired, maybe, and want to make our church a bit more like a peace church. Maybe a lot more like a peace church, or a new kind of peace church. Third, land for the dispossessed. You've been dispossessed because you never had any, or because they kicked you off it. But you're dispossessed of your land. You don't have it. You're landless. The faith community in the streets. Be reading this. Remember I said, look for parallels or connections to us. The faith community in the streets. When that St. Nicholas group got going, they were in the streets. The gang saw them there. The police saw them there. The recruiters saw them there. Wait a minute. What are these women and children and men doing in the streets? They're supposed to be afraid of us. This was actually number five. I did it wrong. Resilient women. I end up saying this about once every visit to Holden, but I'm worried about the gender balance in heaven. Ask me later what I mean. A community displaced but united. They all got kicked off, but you know what they do? They try to settle again together on a dump, in a slum, but they try to stick together to keep the strength of their community. The paramilitaries might have seized their land and turned it into a coca plantation. Or the U.S. might have sprayed it and killed everything so the farmers can't grow anymore. So they're in the city, but they stay together. And then finally, Days of Prayer and Action for Peace in Colombia. Every year in late April, I think in 2008, the last report I have, I haven't been involved in this. It started after I left LWR and went overseas, but great idea. 300 churches in the U.S. and Canada doing actions of prayer, actions in prayer for peace in Colombia. A little bit like what I talked about with Israel-Palestine, the one at the end of May each year. In that context, if you aren't up for a week of peace, consider this. And here's the bite-sized entry-level peace ministry for all of you in your parish. There are, there is in the world now a United Nations International Day of Peace. And that's 21st of September every year. And I can't remember why they picked 21 September, but there was sort of an okay reason. Tough to pick a day for the whole world to pay attention to. But it's there, and in some countries it's really a big deal. The boss of the WCC, the World Council of Churches, went to see Kofi Annan. We had an African General Secretary who went to see the African Secretary General of the WCC in 2003. And they agreed that the WCC and churches around the world could promote this as it is, International Day of Peace. That's fine. If that's all you want to do, do it. There's absolutely nothing wrong. It's actually very right for churches to celebrate a day like that with everybody else in the world who's celebrating it. But Kofi Annan agreed that we could also call it International Day of Prayer for Peace. And so running parallel, and maybe mixed, maybe not mixed, but running parallel on 21st September is the idea of International Day of Prayer for Peace. And the WCC will have a little bit of material about it, something you can do in your church, some ideas, some links to groups who are doing things. And I know of at least two organizations here in the States, the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and another group from the Church of the Brethren that are busy linking up the Day of Peace with their work, with attention to projects like this, with prayers. It's a day to put things in front of people and maybe to see the connection. Yes?
In 2000, when the second Intifada began in Israel-Palestine, the Lutheran bishop, H. George Anderson, divided the month for each state to have some sort of a prayer observance, and Washington's is the 18th of every month. And so on the 18th of every month, we have a prayer vigil from noon to 12:30. And we haven't missed a month. I put it together. Our pastor said, fine, go for it. But and I'm willing to share what I put together as a pattern or whatever. But anyway, we haven't missed a month, even when we're gone on it. Get somebody else to do it, but peace is possible.
Thank you. I'm going to use the remaining time to close briefly on Colombia, have a bit more discussion if you need it or would like it, and then spend a little bit of time back on the macro picture. But to close this, in this great report from the Church Peace Work in Colombia, this is for 2008, it's right out of Holden's theme, Churches as Seeds of Hope, the sacred yes of the peacemaking community of faith. What can the Colombian people of faith say in the face of corruption, injustice, and protracted violence? Colombian churches speak truth through being intentional and active peacemaking communities. Their sacred yes confronts the narrative of human lies. Their witness both condemns violence and invites redemption. Churches contrast the truth that they know with the future they're called to by meeting human needs and confronting the powers that prey on the vulnerable. Through their embrace of peace and justice, they declare peace is possible. Their faith-based and God-sustained choice of risky peacemaking constitutes a sacred yes to help show Colombia the path out of violent conflict. And I said at the beginning, it's 50 years. It's, I think, the longest-running civil conflict, in violent conflict in the world. So here's four yeses from the churches in Colombia. Yes to the truth of the personal stories of persecuted victims, which are often denied by the government. Yes to restorative justice that strives to make all things and all people new. Yes to healing rather than nursing wounds to justify revenge. So heal the wounds, don't nurse them to justify revenge. And yes to dialogue for warring parties who have been speaking only through bullets. Again, there are a lot of parallels here. What do we speak through? Most of us don't use guns, I hope, but What do we speak, which actions of ours do we speak through which are actually not peaceful? And you can think of others here. I said I would read you their recommendation to the U.S. government. I think I better do that because it isn't long and it gives you a sense. This is recommendation number 11 at the end of the book for the Lutheran World Relief and other church groups do advocacy in Washington about Colombia. Because all this violence I'm talking about, we are actually as close as the second biggest foreign aid program in the world. Israel's the first, this is the second. And it's all about spraying coca plants, which are actually the way of life for the farmers. I mean, that's what they live off of. And you just have to say, aren't they just being good businessmen? Isn't the problem our problem? You know, and how big is our drug problem? Is it just people who take cocaine? Watch the television. What are they advertising? It's stunning when you come back to this country. The amount of television advertising for drugs, legal medicines and things. It's just beyond belief. And cocaine has got to be part of that. And it's got to be part of why we spray whole mountainsides, whole valleys with herbicides. So here's the recommendation. Rather than providing military aid, prioritize social aid and peace initiatives as well as assistance for strengthening democratic institutions. And the U.S. does some of that. It's not all military. They are supporting some peace projects. But the right hand and the left hand have to agree about why they're there, and they don't. And most of the money's in the military hand. The rule of law, structures and procedures that end impunity and improve the effectiveness of the judicial branch. The need for the courts to be independent in any country, including ours. Adopting these recommendations, which prioritize victims, sufferers, seek an approach to governing that recognizes the greatest needs and speaks to faith in a negotiated solution to the conflict. This would be a significant change in U.S. policy. Speak to faith in a negotiated solution to the conflict. This is translated from Spanish. Excellent stuff in Spanish. Okay, and then the second paragraph. Adopt a new anti-narcotics policy that recognizes the negative impacts and the futility of aerial spraying. The current policy has had the contradictory effect of making small-scale farmers more dependent on illicit crops. We emphatically request that the new policy focus specifically on drug addiction and the demand for illegal drugs in the U.S. Questions or comments about Colombia? Some of those moments. Yes, we have great.
I've been to Colombia and it has the greatest diversity of birds in the world. And I just think about this spraying. Yeah. It just breaks my heart.
Well, you're here when I said you can eat a different fruit every day.
Yeah, it's just, I mean,
it's biodiversity.
It's more blessed than any place.
Yeah.
Really. It's just amazing.
No, I think it's God's a little bit of a reminder for us what the Garden of Eden is probably like. So what a place to have this going on. Yeah.
The complexities of the issues are just like overwhelming because, you know, you talk about exchanging warfare for social, you know, issues. But, you know, you look at bad development throughout the third world, and it creates the same dependency issues that you're talking about happens with the spraying, you know, and it's just... It's in, you know, you've got the supply demand thing that the demand is from the United States going over there. So you've got the economic factors, and then you've got just so many. There's just such a big mess. It's just almost unbelievable to think that, you know, I think, but you're not of all kinds of people that could ever get undone. But, you know, but for the grace of God, that's why we're here, I suppose.
Yeah, we've had a lot of empowerment, hope. These 2 weeks I've been here. From coming to these classes and listening to what people say and the examples they're giving,
mm-hmm.
Bible study. So it's absolutely the moment to just say to ourselves, together with God and with each other, no problem, honestly. It's not beyond redemption. And what's so powerful about these guys is you meet them, you know, they're the kind of people you just wouldn't even open your mouth to talk to if you're just following your normal instincts. What would I say? I can't speak their language. I'm not them. I'm so different. All the emotions you have. But you sit with them and you find out they're doing exactly what you're talking about. And from a what looks to me a lot more difficult starting point.
Are you talking about the Mennonites or Greek?
The women in the Commodore.
Oh, okay.
You know, the ministries I was at the, when I was giving those examples. And another thought it gives to me is, what did Jesus mean by blessed are the poor? For they shall see God. I think actually, when you go there, you realize they're seeing God with better eyesight than we are. And so, that you can work on that. We can work on that. We can make connections. Yes, in the back.
Was there any hope of solving problems there if we don't take care of the drug problem in this country, which is creating demand? Even if we clean it up there, we'll just move to another country.
Yeah. Well, and what do we have most access to? Our backyard, you know, work in our own backyard rather than their backyard.
Yeah.
No, it's an amazing choice. It's just a totally amazing choice of policy. And it's a huge story. It's been going on for 15 years. It's what we tried to do to Viet. Remember when we couldn't find the Viet Cong, so we thought we'd denude the jungle with Agent Orange so we could find our enemies? I mean, this is depressing. Yes, sir.
Reducing demand for cocaine is a long in this country is a long-term project. I mean, it's taken us several generations to reduce demand for tobacco, but there's still, you know, about 20% of the population or something that smokes, and it's only relocated the tobacco companies are mostly just working overseas now. But my point being that tobacco, the industry of growing tobacco and distributing tobacco, as nasty as it is, does not involve wholesale countrywide political and economic, you know, violence like the cocaine industry does. And that's because the tobacco industry is legal and therefore to some extent regulated. I'm wondering whether you to what extent do you think the problem is caused by our attempts at drug prohibition, and in my view, have not succeeded any better than our attempt at alcohol prohibition succeeded.
Yeah, no, I mean it's a I think a real good point, but I think prohibition is in the category of symptoms and treatments. It's not root causes.
I see.
Honestly, I mean I think it's not my field, but. It's absolutely stunning to see how much our economy is dominated by legal ads for legal men for legal drugs, and I'm sure it's got to be connected. I think there's a lot of things we can touch in that area, but that's a whole different topic, and we're not going to do it justice.
But we don't seem to have violence coming from illegal drugs. You know, it's a regulated industry, and it's reasonably clean.
Yeah, well,
maybe what we have is cultural apathy coming because everybody's so drugged up all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe even opium's a big part of the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Huge! Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of opium in our legal drugs.
Huge.
Painkillers.
Yeah. No, the nexus of guns, remember that our guns are also going south. Our military is going south and the guns we sell. You heard about the guy who in Minnesota who was going to Cabela's and buying a trunk full of guns? Driving to Mexico and selling it? He did it 10, 20 times. They finally caught him. Did Cabela's ask, excuse me, sir, your credit card shows us, you know, I mean, please. But your hand was up first. Sorry.
Fellowship of Reconciliation for some years has focused on trying to, in Colombia, has tried to encourage volunteers to go as accompaniers or accompaniment to local groups that are trying to establish peace. Would you comment on whether you think that's effective?
Well, I know it from Palestine, and I think it's got problems, but it's absolutely a worthy idea if it's done right, if it's done sensitively, if you're there to listen and to witness, not to get in the way of the local people on either side, but stand by them, walk with them, the word accompaniment is the number one word in peace thoughts in Latin America. Walking with, being on the way with, which raises huge spiritual opportunities also from the way we think. So I think it's actually really good. They've asked us to do the same thing we're doing in Palestine also. CPT, I think. FOR is there, I4 is there. I think CPT is, does anybody know? In Colombia. But the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Israel-Palestine has been asked to make a Colombian version.
Yeah, to talk to response to being overwhelmed, I think we let the whole overwhelm because there's so many things go out. I mean, you know, again, as I've said before, John, you're so tremendously depressing, John, because, you know, there's all the problems, Israel, it's Palestinians, Colombia, and we can be paralyzed because we're overwhelmed with that. But one of the gifts of the Spirit is that notion of patience. And I think a better translation of it, of hypomone in the Greek, it means faithful resistance. And that's why, and I mean, I'm joking when I say you're, I mean, you, what the WCC is doing, what many of you are doing in your specific ways, are you are engaged in faithful resistance. That all those things are going on and you're saying, no, I will not be a part of that. Or as church, no, we will not be a part of that. God's way is a different way. And we will work. We will faithfully resist that story of domination and all those other things. And so I think, indeed, that's a tremendous sign of hope. And, you know, we need not be overwhelmed because each one of us and our communities can engage in that faithful resistance many, many different ways. So simply do it in the way that works for you and your community. And that's the gift of the Spirit. Sign of hope.
Thank you. We can do it together. And I think that the discussions here are just a little example of that. If you go to different kinds of classes, you connect the water thing with what I've been saying with the Bible studies, and you start to see, we can. And our church ought to be the place where this happens. The people in Colombia say, they say, peace is not, I wrote it down when I was there, peace is not a thing. Peace is something that you do, something that you give, something that you are, something that you receive. It's not a thing. It's not, you can't say, you can't talk about it out there as if it's out there. It's something that you do, you are, you give, you receive. And God, obviously. And I thought that was, you know, helps us to get closer to this and do it together. Let me finish by sharing with you a little bit what came out last night when some of you were here. We broke up into little groups and we said, where do we see our connection to peace? What are the challenges, possibilities for us in these four themes? In the community, with the earth, in the marketplace, among the peoples and nations. The more international one, the more local one, the more international. The main things that came out of that discussion, which was interrupted by the fire alarm, was the idea that you can't think of them separately, really, because you instantly see connections between them. And the one that came out, I think, was with the water movie the previous night. Bottling water and paying more for it than gasoline and using 30 billion bottles a year, just in this country, let alone the rest of the world, 30 billion plastic water bottles. You want to do something? Stop plastic water bottles. I mean, that should be the first thing, making hope that everybody can get their hands around. But it's absolutely connected up with this and with this. Huge pollution. They're made from petroleum. Aren't we dependent on petroleum from that troublesome part of the world we don't know, understand, and get along with very well because we're so out of joint there as well. And we're using that to make water bottles that we don't need to make, where they bottle some little community's municipal water and sell it to you for, you know, a dollar. It costs them a cent. I mean, it's like, that's a connection to peace. The connections between these areas. And they're at hand. They're in your pocketbook. They're in your shopping cart. I'll just finish the quick thing from last night. The connection between our consumption and the impoverishment or abuse of others. The idea that efficiency is not the same thing as sustainability. And we value efficiency, we don't value sustainability. So sustainability being a way for us to judge ourselves about are we in line with God's intention for all living things under this category and that category and the others. And then or one person saying they really couldn't think of too much because they felt far from the issue and maybe needed to find a way to understand their connections to it. I wanted to share with you the way, oh, you had a question, sir.
I just comment that people don't seem to realize you can actually refill a water bottle and use it 2 or 3 times.
Yeah. Well, I like the tap, you know?
Yeah.
You're just drinking tap water. I like the cup and the tap. I asked a bunch of, I'll finish with this, a little inspiration for you. I asked in the sense that you're not in this alone. Other countries actually have a lot to show us about these issues. I have to tell you, living in Europe, the response to climate change is light years ahead of here, light years ahead of here. I could just fill the rest of the day with examples that you just run across if you follow the news. But so I asked a group of 21-year-old Germans, 30 of them, who came to Geneva to visit the Ecumenical Center of the World Council of the Lutheran World Federation. And they're all training to be religious education teachers in German high schools. They have public-supported religious education. And I said, which of these things do you relate to? And what do you think of when you think of them? In about 4 minutes, this is what they came up with. Under the first one, media violence. The prevalence of violent models in peace in the community. There's violence at a level that no human being would survive a day or a minute. You know, what's the figure? How many murders do you see a day on television? But it's much more than that. The whole celebrity culture, as well as the games culture, is all related to unlivable models that are essentially violent. They brought that up big. They also said, we're raised to compete. These are Germans, remember? They do really well at building good cars and other things like that. They got so carried away with how good they were, they took on the rest of the world twice in the last century. And still today, even though they've done all this work about peace in Germany, more than any other country I know, putting the ghosts of the past behind them, these young adults said, are being raised to compete, to get good grades, to be winners. This individualistic idea of success is essentially violent. It's the root of violence. It's the, well, turn it around and say it positively. It's incompatible with peace in the community. And it gets better. Talk about it as a block to peace. Competition is okay, but it can't be the top value. Because then it's us, all this us and them stuff. Under the earth, they talked about a responsible way of living. Everybody needs to have a responsible way of living. We just mentioned a minute ago with the bottled waters. As a tiny example, but very doable, but there are many such examples. Somebody last night was going to throw away their toaster because it didn't work. Here's what I do because I'm so weird. I came home and stayed with my brother-in-law. I hope he doesn't hear this tape. They had a brand new toaster oven, and the little Bakelite handle broke the first time they used it. I got up the next morning, I went through the garage, and here's the toaster oven in the dumpster. Because the Bakelite handle was broken. What? Think of the net effect of that kind of behavior. And as other countries think that's prosperity and how we need to live too. Okay, under environment they talked about responsible ways of living. Under economics, they talked about mass change of behavior. How does it take for a society? We're talking a little bit with cocaine and drugs and so on. And your point about smoking is great, because honestly, being away a lot, that's huge here. America's the least smokingest. Europe is way behind on that. They haven't done that. How did that happen? It wasn't rocket science. We can do the same thing in other areas. We put our minds to it. We have way less litter than we used to. We can change, mass change of behavior. They thought of that as the answer on the economic side. And then peace among the peoples, they said, We need to grow up valuing quality between people rather than superiority, thinking of ourselves as better than others. So this group, maybe that's why they're going to be religion teachers, but they went deep each time, and they did this analysis very quickly and came back with deep analysis of peace requires us to be cooperative, not competitive, to adopt behaviors that the planet can handle if everybody lives that way. And in this case, to look for equality rather than competition. I'd like to close with the prayer that was at the end of that vow of nonviolence that we took here at Holden 10, 12 years ago. So if you'll join me in a closing short prayer. Gracious God, we trust in your sustaining love. We believe that just as you gave us the desire to make this vow of nonviolence, to think of nonviolence, to talk about it here today, so will you grant us grace to fulfill it. Thank you for the gift of community that supports and challenges us to walk the way of nonviolence, the way of the cross, the way of life. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you.